Hey, folks, welcome to another edition of the Corner Store Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Koval. We have in the building the squad, back at it again, reassembled post holiday break. We have Max the Snack Door, who's eating a big snack, a healthy snack, maybe lunch, really. He's eating in the corner store. Mercedes Zapata, the photographer, social media maven, is in the corner store. DJ Cashera is a real-life superhero, saved an old lady who needed to jumpstart her car. And also the homie Mariah Neuroth is in the building, all in the corner store today. And we have a really special episode because we have a man who has been putting on for creating the culture of hip hop in Chicago, in company, in choir with, I would say, a first generation crew of practitioners in the city. Someone who also started the well known and very important Chi Rock Nation, a documenter, an all around b-boy, DJ, MC, graffiti writer. We have Daryl Artistic Roberts in the corner store. Sir, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Excited to talk with you, man.
Yes.
It's been a long time coming.
Yes.
Yeah. Before we get started, a few things. One, we're going to get your socials at the end, but if you could give out your social media so people who are listening up top, they could follow along and be in tune with all that you're doing. Where's a good place to get you?
I'm on Facebook under my name, Daryl M. Roberts Artistic. And then on Instagram, I'm also up under Daryl M. Roberts or Artistic, Chi Rock Nation.
Great. And also, Max always secures snacks for our guests in the corner store. Today is no different. Max got for you a good-sized Gatorade Frost Crisp and Cool Thirst Quencher.
Okay.
So that's for you. All right.
Thank you.
And then in addition, feel free to enjoy that now. Also, in addition, some cheese-flavored okey-doke popcorn. It's only $1.49.
Nice.
I guess Okie Doke was bought.
Thank you.
But like, they were acquired by Jay's. I didn't realize that. I don't know when that, Jay's has a kind of monopoly out here. I don't know. They're just buying up these smaller regional, popcorn company. I don't know what they're doing. Anyway, the point is, welcome, man.
Yes.
Thank you for being here. We have a giant history to talk about.
Yes.
But you've been doing it all kind of since the beginning.
Yep, pretty much.
So... let's start there. I mean, you come from, where do you come from?
Well, I'm born and raised here in Chicago. I come from the southeast side. Grew up on 101st right off of State Street. And kind of got introduced to it watching shows like Soul Train.
Yes. Okay.
During the 70s.
Yeah.
And
because they had, so how early do you remember? Because was there b-boying at some point on Soul Train, but there were the earlier iterations of various dances that became kind of known as b-boying,
right?
Probably out of like funk. I'm thinking like funk dance and ticking maybe in the 70s from the West Coast or
right.
What else? Like, what was right. were you into dance already, or you just saw that and that inspired you?
Well, that's what got me into dance.
Yeah,
I mean, Soul Train was definitely epic. When it came to that, dance, fashion, music, all of that up and above. But definitely the early days were, like you say, locking and popping, on Soul Train. But it really connected right into the B-boy era, And, in the early 80s when videos started to come out, Friday Night Jams, Friday Night Videos, and some of the other like MTV, some of the networks that began to start showcasing it, it started to flood in, it was like a floodgate, pouring in. And then we had a local radio station that was a big help too in Chicago called WHPK.
Yeah. The only station that would fuck with rap. Right?
There you go.
Yeah, well, shout out JP Chill. Right. Who are some of the other early, because that was really kind of, I remember that as being one of the lone places you could listen to hip hop.
Right.
Who was it, JP, or were there others who were putting on?
Well, I actually just talked to the guy. His name is Kevin Wiskner. I think that's how he pronounced his last name. But he was originally from New York, but he moved to Chicago in 1974. And he went to the University of Chicago for school and got connected right into radio, And, at the time thought it was a good thing to start a rap show because there were no rap shows in Chicago at that point. So he said he had records and he started collecting records and he had enough to do a whole show. And that started in 1984, first rap show in Chicago.
Right. And so this is significant because I think it's hard to imagine in this moment that before then there was no hip hop on the radio.
Yeah.
Right. There was nothing. It was a desert, more or less. They would play some crossover, you know, what we might consider now as pop hits.
Right.
But this was because now you go to your phone, you got all the hip hop at your fingertips.
Yeah.
So this was a did you already were in love with the music by then? Did you know as hip hop? Like, how did you?
Because, you know, like, you know, obviously during the 70s, disco was popular. So, soul, jazz,
Who's playing this music in your house? Is it your folks have these records?
Well, my family did play music. My uncle, my aunt, my mom, you know, they loved Motown, the people from Motown. I mean, you know, I remember seeing records in our house, little 45s, you know, record labels like, of course, Motown, Stax Records, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, and these
all Midwest shit, too.
Definitely. Yeah. And like I say, with TV and all of that going on and hearing the music, it just kind of like captured you, you know. And, you know, like my family wasn't really a big musical type of family, but we love to listen to music, you know. And so, you know, when I kind of started listening to it more and more, I'm like, wow, you know, this is certain type of music. James Brown was big, too. You know, James Brown was just instrumental in hip hop in general and just people in the world, just like, you know, so, you know, but for me personally, I definitely remember the early 80s because that's when, you know, 1979, the Sugar Hill Gang came out with Rapper's Delight.
Yes.
And at the time.
Do you remember this record?
Yes.
Coming out.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. And at the time it was being played everywhere. You know, and, you know, of course, none of us really, at least I didn't understand what this was or where it was going, but it was definitely something new and different. You heard people rhyming over a beat and everybody was playing this record, you know, and so Curtis Blow came out, you know, same year, you know.
And how old are you about?
I'm 1979. I'm 8 years old.
Okay. So you're a young kid. What are you thinking when you're beginning to hear this new chant over, you know, essentially a disco beat at that time?
Yeah. It, when you're young, you hear stuff, but you don't necessarily understand the elements of what you're hearing.
Of course.
But you know, you can feel something that's different.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, you know, I'm digging this. And then the more you hear it, you kind of get conditioned to, wow, you know.
You start to remember it a little bit.
Yeah.
Kids love rhyming.
I think it's one of the most, you know, Rapper's Delight is probably one of the most memorized songs throughout the history of hip hop. You know, so that it just continued to, you know, and then Michael Jackson was a big, you know, early 80s, you know, 83, 84, because of what he was doing, you know, and even though he wasn't necessarily hip hop, but as a pop artist, you know, and the influence that he got from the streets through hip hop.
Please let them know, because I mean, I think not enough people have those notes.
Yes.
Right. That like Michael Jackson is also learning from like some of the Rock Steady Crew, right, in terms of how to moonwalk and things like this.
In my research, because I'm actually going to have a segment in my book about it. So Michael Jackson worked with at least a dozen different street dancers, perhaps even more, at one point in time to get trained to learn how to do some of the moves that he was doing.
Right.
You know, in fact, you know, when he did the Motown 25, where he did what actually was originally called the backslide, you know, when he did that move, a lot of people thought he invented it, but because he did it so well. But, you know, he was trained by the street dancers.
Right. Yeah. Very significant. So at what point do you start to want to, because dance is the first thing for you?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You used to be in a myriad of b-boy crews.
Mm-hmm.
How early were you putting together a crew?
I started dancing in 82. I had a friend named Brian who came. He actually is from Chicago, but he went to California and then he came back. And by the time he came back, he was, you know, one of the top poppers in our neighborhood.
Right. So he was taking a West Coast style of dance and bringing it to the Midwest.
Yes.
Significant.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, one day, you know, we was out down the street in front of the houses on our block. And one of the neighbors said, "Hey, Brian, go ahead and do that popping stuff." and he threw this wave from one iron to the next, and it didn't look like he had a bone in his body, you know, and I was just totally shocked. I was like, wow, do that again, do that again. I mean, you know, like, what the heck? And, you know, he did it, and he just started, he, you know, doing robot and, you know, just fascinating. And at that point, we started a crew. Yeah, you know, and we called ourselves the Egyptian Breakers.
Right. Yes. Okay. Now, I read about this in Lior's piece. Shout out Lior Galil, who wrote a great piece about you and, you know, for the reader just a few months back.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember reading that you, why did you come up with that name?
You know, we was trying to be, you know, it wasn't like we had ever been to Egypt or anything like that. But we were trying to be different. And I think we had a tutting style, you know, because, you know, when you do the tut, it kind of refers to Egypt.
Absolutely.
And so for some reason, we just decided to call ourselves the Egyptian Breakers, and we just stuck with it.
That's dope. And you went by a different name at that time, too.
Back then, I called myself Awesome D.
Amazing. Yeah, good. Right, because you kept the Daryl, you kept the D.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
I love it. All right, so you guys became, what did that mean to become a crew in...
It was just a given. I mean, because crews started popping up all over movies like Flashdance came out, B Street came out in 84. In fact, 84 was pivotal because B Street Breaking 1 and Breaking 2 came all out in 84.
Breaking 2 came out in 84.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
So those, and that was the
first. Let's build this franchise.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was just like, this is Hollywood now. It's like, you know, everybody.
Right.
And dancing was on every street corner throughout every community. We used to come downtown a lot and dance on Michigan Avenue and Rush Street,
yes.
You know, because it would always be a lot, tons of people crowding around when we started dancing and, you know, give us money and just be fascinated by the dance because it was new to the world.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow. Okay. So were there a lot of other, you knew a lot of other young people doing, you know, did you call it breaking?
Yeah. Well, you know, we originally called it breaking, also b-boying.
Yes.
You know, it originated from New York, but here in Chicago, we definitely called it breaking.
I heard one time, maybe you could clarify this. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of mystery about, you know, who did what when, and, mm-hmm. you know, the best conversations I've heard is when people, you know, it's an ecology and you can't, it's really hard to pinpoint this particular moment, but I've heard the case be made that Chicago roller rinks were some of the pioneering places for footwork on the ground and that eventually gravitated towards some New York style of dance that became known as b-boying.
Yes.
And those roller rink styles were innovated in the 60s here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if that's myth or my own misunderstanding of a lineage, but is there any
well, from what I've kind of gathered through my research and just my experience, is Chicago definitely had a stirring pot at roller rinks, because not only could you skate, but you could dance,
right?
So I mean, obviously stepping started here in Chicago, most people would agree. And so but you know, in the 70s, when you had the locking and the popping coming up, and again, Soul Train was instrumental for a lot of us, because we tuned into that to see what they were doing and how they were doing it, which encouraged all of us to go practice and you know, increase our skills. So, you know, I can see that, because, you know, we used to go skating and it was like twofold. You know, we go skate and we dance,
right?
You know, and also with Chicago being well known for the development of house music and just the house culture, it was like two forces that kind of was against each other, but at the same time, growing at the same time.
Yeah, because at the time you're starting a b-boy crew, house is also beginning to take a very strong hold amongst young people in the city. Were you a part of that community as well? I feel like you had to be.
Well, I liked it, house music, but I wouldn't classify myself as a house head.
Right.
You know, yeah. I knew a lot of people that loved it, but, I mean, I liked the music, but I just, you know, hip-hop drew me in more.
Yes,
you know,
right.
And, you know, and again, they were two opposing forces, because house people did what they did and hip hoppers did what we did. So, you know, and a lot of times it was difficult for us to even enjoy when we went out to an event.
Different
like a party.
BPM, right?
Yeah. You know, because, you know, you know, it's different. It's a little difficult to dance to a house track versus a rap track, you know. So, but it was interesting because, you know, obviously there were tons of house DJs rocking in their basement or in their garage and even in the clubs, and they paved the way to make their history, you know. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why Chicago hasn't come out, so to speak, on a large scale, quicker on the map like other cities is because of the competitiveness that we had with house music. Because, I mean, you know, the house labels and just all the DJs were doing what they were doing, and it kind of pushed hip hop in Chicago back, so to speak. Whereas New York didn't have that. You know what I'm saying? They didn't, you know, they had a full fledged force to develop, and California as well.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, because house for a very long time, and I think in the hearts and minds of a lot of people, still is the preeminent electro music form of that time. I mean, hip-hop has become pop culture. Mm-hmm. But in Chicago, maybe for a long time, and again, maybe even now, house has been more pervasive.
Yes.
And especially in the era in the 80s in which you're speaking.
Yes. Yeah, definitely, like, you know, when the Hot Mix 5 came out on WBMX, and we're talking 81, 82, you know, I mean, and this was like, I remember listening to this music, and like you say, electro music, and then the tracks that was coupled with it from the house music, and I was just like, wow, you know, okay. But then they would mix rap and house together.
Yeah, well, then hip house right, in Chicago for that
brief,
but also really interesting and I think brilliant time. I mean, I was a fan of hip house because I loved both musics.
Yes,
and that was a marriage that I was really interested in.
Yep.
You know, as a kid, and still am.
Yeah.
So all right. So you start the crew, Egyptian Breakers. You start to battle other crews?
That was a part of it. I mean, and that was one of the reasons why we developed a crew, because it had got to the point where it was crews coming up all over the place, and we kept practicing trying to get good, and it was all about competing. You know, hip-hop is very competitive. So you see one guy doing a move, and then if he throws something to you and he call you out, you're not going to just stand there and let him tear you up. You know, so it's like, oh, what's up? You know, so there goes the battle, you know. And the good thing about it is it was developed to keep us from fighting. You know, if you do the history on New York hip hop, I mean, they came from the gang culture to the creative culture, you know. And the whole idea when Bambada and all of them guys in New York got together to do parties, it was just like, let's stop the fighting and the hurting of one another, and let's try to be competitively doing something creative.
Yeah, but the same, I mean, that's what I think is so brilliant about hip-hop is that, and I've heard, you know, we had Crazy Legs on the show a few months back or a few weeks back, and he was talking about how he didn't want to romanticize the origins, and certainly the crew, you know, Zulu Nation was an alternative to gang culture, but also was rooted in gang culture, obviously, and I think the brilliance in terms of the structure and the flip in hip-hop organizing is that the crew is really reflective of a street organization that is representing a kind of necessary fill-in family circle. And the crew is meant to kind of foster that kind of brotherhood and sisterhood and camaraderie amongst a generation of young creative people.
Right. And I think, and again, that's the beauty behind hip-hop, in my opinion, because it opens you up to help you express yourself freely. And, you know, I've never seen any other culture like it. I mean, with all of what it has nested in it, it continues to behoove me. You know, I mean, it's just like, I mean, breakdancing or breaking, you know, the media actually started terming it breakdancing because they felt like, oh, they're breaking, it's like they're going to hurt themselves. You know, so they caught wind to the media and they termed it breakdancing. But I have yet to see a dance that is better. You know, I mean, I likened it a lot to gymnastics, but even, you know, with gymnastics, they use a lot of apparatuses, you know, to kind of help them with what their ability to do what they do, even though they still are great.
Yeah.
But with breaking, you don't have nothing but you on the floor.
Well, it's a combination of so many different elements, gymnastics included, but it's also ballet, it's capoeira, it's all sorts of, you know, the local dances influenced, you know, from that region. You could see in a cipher depending on where you're on where you are in the country.
Right.
I think B-boying's coming to the Olympics in 2020.
Yes, that's official.
Right.
Yes.
Which is significant and
amazing. Yeah, matter of fact, they already did the Youth Olympics last year for the first time. And, you know, they had a young person, I forget what countries they were from, but a young person for the male won the gold medal, and then another female person won for the women.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, so they tried it for the youth, and now they're going to go to the adult whenever that's going to showcase, I believe, like you say, you know, 2023 or 2024.
Wow, fly. Do you, well, yeah, We could have a different conversation about that. But so but I'm curious, to, just because I want to get to Chi-Rock Nation.
Okay.
Tell us what that is.
Well, Chi-Rock Nation is, it's a street organization that started on the streets of southeast side of Chicago. And again, we were engulfed in all the elements. You know, we were rapping, we were breakdancing, we were doing graffiti, we were DJing, all of us just embracing the culture. But we definitely was influenced by the Zulu Nation because we studied and watched them with what they were doing, and we liked the concept. But at the same time, we realized that we wanted our own identity. And a lot of us at the time, we were claiming Zulu, but none of us were official members. You know, there are some members here in Chicago.
Yeah, shout out Cassius D.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But for the most part, 95% of the people in Chicago was not Zulu. But if you look at a lot of the early 80s pictures, mid 80s, you would see a lot of people in the picture doing this. And again, you know, as we got older, we began to realize, well, we're repping something that we're really not officially a part of. So the concept came to where we wanted to create something of our own. And the gentleman, Kurok Steady, before he died, he was kind of like, you know, trying to get us to submit, so to speak, to his leadership, because at the time he was claiming that he was the chapter representative for Chicago, for the Zulu Nation. And, you know, he was kind of like insinuating that we need to bow down to him because, you know, he's the king or the representative for Chicago. And that's when we realized, you know, we need to create
our
something of our own.
and I remember Chi-Rock Nation because you guys put on events, parties, gatherings. Mm-hmm. You know, when you started it, you're a young guy who's then seeking to build unity amongst all these other groups in Chicago. That is a pretty significant, but also, you know, we're talking on the day Fred Hampton was murdered, and so that tradition of young people organizing other young people is something that's inherent in Chicago cultural practice too. What made you want to unify or bring people together in that way?
Well, actually, it's a collective, though. So I'm not actually the founder, because it's a collective of, so in other words, we all came from different crews, from different parts of the city, right? So from the remnant of us that was left, there were three crews. And these two of the crews came from the 93rd Street area. And then one of the crews came from the south suburbs, Harvey.
What years are we?
We're talking like 1985.
Okay. And you say remnants because b-boying also kind of it spiked in people's imagination and in the public sphere, and then it kind of dipped down.
Yeah, I would definitely say by 1985 it had almost took a full nosedive,
right?
And only for the people that really loved it and understood what this was coming to be continued to stay. But
yes,
some people, they left and, you know, went back to game banging, or some people went into the house arena, you know, when whatever they went, whatever way they wanted to go. But you know, I definitely think that, you know, to me, it was like a bear hug for me. And I was just like, this right here, yeah, I've never seen anything like it. And same year in 1985, I got into graffiti. So, you know, I was like, wow, this thing here, all of this works together. You know, this is a, you know, and at the time we were beginning to put the pieces together to see that this is actually a culture. You know, it's not just something that you do as a hobby. You know, even though it started off as a hobby for most of us, but I mean, it became a full time career for a lot of us. A lot of people even thought rap music wasn't even going to last. They was like, oh, that's not even real music. That's just, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's not a real dance. You know, you can't compete with trained dancers on a stage, you know, and all of that. So they kind of downed hip hop, you know, full circle. But every year it continued to grow and develop. So with the Chi-Rock Nation, though, with the individuals that came together, of about 20 different individuals that came together, and we decided, you know, to put this brand, so to speak, Chi-Rock, which is short. Chi is short for Chicago. R-O-C-K is respect our creative kind. So, and we stuck with that, and, ever since. And so, you know, I joined the organization in 1987. So they were already kind of in full swing by the time I came along.
Right.
And when I came in, I made a promise to myself that I was going to represent the organization full force for hip hop, because I clearly seen what they were doing. And I'm just like, this no needed explanation, because, you know, it's definitely an offshoot of New York. But at the same time, we were branding ourselves to develop our own identity here in Chicago.
How were you brought into graffiti? Because I know that that process is, you know, a lot about mentorship and learning yes. from people around you. So who yes. are some of the folks that brought you into graffiti? And I want to talk about how that influenced an idea, that because I think through graffiti writers is how I came to know mm-hmm. Chi-Rock Nation.
Okay.
But yeah, how did who kind of brought you into that world?
So after Breakin' started taking its nosedive around 1985, which again was the same year that I got into graffiti, I entered high school.
Where'd you go?
I went to Dunbar Vocational High School, and there was a crew there called IAC. It stood for Insane Artist Crew. And these guys were, you know, they were the epitome of graffiti, you know. And, you know, and I would see them, but they were a little older than me. And, you know, so they were kind of like my first influence. But we had neighborhood guys. And then at the same time, WHBK was instrumental to introducing and bringing us together, because every week on WHBK, people would be on there doing requests and shout outs and all of that. And we would hear these names, and then they would tell us when a party was coming or whatever. And we would go to these parties, and that's how we would meet physically. Or they would have meetings, or what they call citywide writers meetings. And at that place, wherever we had it at, we would just meet tons and tons of other artists.
Yes.
So it would, that influence.
Where were some of those? Because I remember hearing, I was not a writer, but I knew a lot of writers. I remember hearing about meetings that took place on the steps of the not the Field Museum, the Science and Industry Museum.
Yes, yes. Yeah. We actually, you know what? It's interesting because, so we had places like the Hall of Fame, which is right off of 22nd and Cermak yeah. over in Chinatown. Yeah. We had
which does not exist, has been paved or, I guess, developed on.
Yes, right. Yes. Yeah. They've actually built up residential buildings over there now. So yeah. it's definitely different from what it was in the 80s. But we had a spot on 93rd and Kimbart, in the area where Chi-Rock was born, called the Wall of Sin. And that was an outdoor abandoned factory that we used to paint in. And then we would have meetings there. But the Museum of Science and Industry is very key to Chicago hip hop history, because we decided one day, and we're talking like 88, 89, that we wanted to have a meeting citywide again, but not just for the graffiti writers, just hip hop in general. And we met at the Museum of Science and Industry. And we started trying to have meetings inside the museum as young kids, as young teenagers. And the meetings was growing and getting bigger and bigger. And it started creating a problem, because the security was like, you know, you guys, you can't be in here dancing and rapping and doing what we were doing. So
what a missed opportunity, right, for the Science and Industry Museum. I wonder if there's a way to rectify that and maybe bring that back, because they broke it up, right?
Yeah, they got to the point to where we literally was kicked out of the museum.
Right.
Yeah. And then we started having the meetings right out. Outside on the door, like the parking lot area,
yeah,
on the steps.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they just told us, you know, because we were just distracting and disturbing, I guess, to the people that was coming to the museum. So they said, you have to get off the property, you know. And then we went from that point, we went across the street to this little shelter, and that became our meeting spot. And we had began to meet there for years, and we named it the Terror Dome. Public Enemy had just came out in 1990 with Welcome to the Terror Dome.
And so this is in Hyde Park.
Yes.
Now, what I know about the point in Hyde Park in mm-hmm. the 90s is it was one of the spaces where b-boying was also kept alive, because mm-hmm. there were practice sessions. I don't know what crew was holding them, but there were practice sessions at the point where, in my understanding, you know, in some of what I was privy to, certainly b-boying, Southside,
yes.
b-boying stayed alive.
Yes.
In that space.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, which is very close to where the Terror Dome, I imagine, must have been.
Yeah. I mean, there were definitely pockets of places that nurtured graffiti, MCing, DJing, and rap. But, you know, you had to be connected to where these places and spots were at, you know, because if not, you wouldn't even think it existed. Because after like Breakin' died, on the mainstream, it was still going on in the underground. So you still kind of had to know where to go to see it.
Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah, you needed to know somebody to know.
Yeah.
You know, you needed to get a flyer from somewhere.
Yes.
You needed to be out in the world and have like a face-to-face interaction so you could get the next thing.
Yes.
Because there were not, I mean, until I the first regular public space I remember for that I went to anyway that was regular was mm-hmm. was Jesse De La Peña's
yes.
Blue Groove Lounge.
Yes.
And I remember the B-Side Cafe, on, okay. I think it was on Belmont. They had some sort of regular night for a little while. And there were all ages clubs like Medusa, but they weren't playing breaks right. or hip hop music
right.
necessarily.
Right.
But yeah, it was still so far from being pop culture.
Yes.
That you had to, there was a point, I'm sure, I say like where you could look at somebody on the train and know whether or not they were into hip hop.
Yeah,
by the way they moved, by the way they dressed. And that was how I met people, you know, because I would just go up to them. I'd be like, you know, because it was obvious and it was still so few of us, it felt like.
Right.
That I could ask somebody, like, are you into hip hop?
Yeah.
Or are you a writer?
Yeah.
Because I could tell, like, if they had paint on their clothes, I'm like, you're a writer. Like, where should I go look at work, basically?
Yeah. You know, in the 80s, we used to do what they call getting up. So whether it was with a marker or a spray paint can or shoe dye. So the actual shoe dye that you would use to dye your shoes was a very popular tool amongst graffiti writers. And they would take that bottle of Griffin shoe dye and put it in their back pocket. And a lot of times, you know, it stained anything that it touched. So you would have like black stains on your back pocket. You know, and that was an identifying mark as to he must be a graffiti writer.
Wow. Yeah, that's really good. So you rap too.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
When did that come into the
mix? So in 1985, I started rhyming and I started doing graffiti all at the same time because, again, I went to high school and it was around the time Run DMC was very popular. They were playing their music on WHBK all the time.
You're wearing the Kango. It's a nod because Run DMC wore black versions of those.
Yes.
It also reminds me, of course, of LL, but the bell shaped Kango, in gray, looking like a very with the jean jacket on top. Run DMC was really it, right?
Yeah, they were pivotal. I mean, and when we first started rhyming, I was kind of patterning my style of rap off of them because they were molding and breaking barriers in terms of what they were doing when it came to rap, and that they were so iconic.
Oh my God.
You know, the image that they, you know, I mean, they made the song My Adidas, and I mean, you know, so when we were hearing that music, 85 they came out with King of Rock, 86 they came out with Raising Hell, and their music was just constantly being played, you know, and I'm talking about local radio, you know, but then it started getting mainstream as well. And
because Raising Hell had that Aerosmith crossover joint too.
Yeah. So, you know, so it was just like, okay, you know, a lot of people, because of HBK, that was our biggest influence, we felt that it's a lot of kids doing it, let's try it. And we had a dude on our block named Ronald who actually had some equipment. And so we actually did some recordings that I still have in my possession.
Wow.
He actually could play live instruments too. And we would go into his house and do recording sessions. You know, we didn't have money to pay for studio time, but because we were right on the block and he had the equipment and we were developing, you know, we kind of partnered together and, you know, we started, you know, laying down stuff and recording it. And, you know, so we made it a demo tape. We took it to WHBK because WHBK was known for playing local talent.
Artists, yeah.
You know, and we took our tape down there, and JP Chill was at the time was like, yeah, we'll get it on. And next thing I know, one day we just listened to HBK and our song comes on the radio.
What?
You know, and we just went nuts.
I'm sure you must have. That's incredible. Like dream come true, right? Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, so it was, you know, and we were in Chicago.
What was the track?
We had made a song called Let It Rock.
Okay.
So, you know, and it was nicely done, you know, with the production, and we all had written our own little rhyme. And our crew, it was seven of us.
Wow.
You know, but, you know, we were breakers and rappers, and a couple of us were graffiti artists.
What was the name of the crew?
So Egyptian Breakers was our breaking name. The Curfew Crew was our rap name.
That's right. Curfew Crew or Curfew Boys?
Well, yeah, we originally called ourselves the Curfew Boys.
Okay, and then it became the Crew.
Yes.
Oh, I still like that name,
yeah,
actually.
And we got that because we was always out past curfew.
Yeah. Now, did you... Okay, so in this whole mix, are your parents like, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah, for sure. My mom, you know, felt like this was a rebellion. You know, like I had a rebellious attitude. And to some degree, that was correct because it was like... You know, graffiti was illegal.
Yeah, hip-hop is a rebel art, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, we fighting against the system, you know. But at the same time, it was nothing that grabbed me any stronger. You know, my mom tried to put me in Boy Scouts, and, you know, I was like, you know, it just didn't do anything for me. It was cool, but it didn't keep me.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, she tried to put me in a music school, and at the time, it wasn't the music that I was learning. Like, you know, you're trying to study the notes and all that. And I wasn't really a person that was trying to become, learn how to read music and play music, like the organ and all of that. I wanted to get good, but I didn't want to study because it was just difficult. But hip hop, it was like nobody had to tell me this is what you got to do because it was automatic connection. So, you know, but my mom, she definitely, I think it was a hardship for her. And a lot of our parents, you know, they were kind of like, you know, you guys keep getting in trouble. You know, we had our encounters with the law. And I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's just concerning for any parent.
Yeah.
And what did your folks do?
Well, my mom, she, at the time when I first got into it, my mom had just kind of started getting spiritually, you know, for her personal development, you know. And so I think that was another thing that kind of was a conflict because she's trying to read the Bible and grow spiritually. And I'm, you know, writing on trains and, you know, I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And so it was like, you know, but at the same time, I was a teenager. So it was just like, OK, what am I supposed to do? You know, this has got me, you know, and I'm sorry. I can't help myself. It's like a drug.
Right. Yeah. Well, especially graffiti. I imagine that adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
Is pretty serious.
Yeah. Yeah. And now my father, he had cut out of my life a long time ago. So I was raised by my aunts and my grandmother.
Yeah.
Because my mom had to work and stuff like that. But I mean, and then the streets. I mean, you know, hip hop kind of raised a lot of us as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now, and I know there's a whole swath of history that we're missing, but you are collecting a history.
Yes.
You are working on documenting and telling the story of hip hop in Chicago in a series of books that you're writing. Tell us about what this series is.
So to start it off, in 1992, I was a subscriber to the Source magazine, and yeah, I had
so many, right? So it was the Bible. They called it the Bible for a reason.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, you know, and they had opened this section in the book for a one pager where they showed graffiti. And they was like, you know, send us your stuff and we'll put it in there. So I did just that. Send them some pictures because I had hundreds of pictures. Send them, you know, and, you know, back then we was using 35 millimeters and, you know, we'd have to go get them developed and prints and stuff like that.
Right.
So I would send them a hard photo and they would never publish any of it. And I kind of felt a certain way. I'm like, wow, you know, every time I look in there, it's all New York stuff, you know. But yet you say, send us your stuff, you'll put it in there. So that's when me and my partner named Fear, he was also my mentor, graffiti mentor. We decided, you know what? We just started taking pieces of paper. It's like, hey, you know, we got pictures. Let's, you know, we just start laying stuff out, cut and paste.
A zine, making a zine. Yeah. Which is DIY hip hop entrepreneurial to the core. Yeah.
And we had no idea. We had no experience with publishing. I didn't even own a computer. But we had love for hip hop, and that was the driving force. So, you know, we started laying this stuff all out. We took it to Kinko's. I think we were using Office Max and Kinko's, and we made black and white copies. Took it to a couple of stores. One of the first stores we took it to was Fort City. My man Doug Infinite had a skate shop called Underground Wheels.
Shout out Doug Infinite, who lives in the Bay and is homies with my buddy Adam Mansback.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So Doug was one of the first stores that we put the magazine in, and they start selling. We
were
selling
called Chi-Rock Nation?
Yeah. Well, the magazine, we called it Chicago Rocks.
Chicago Rocks, yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And at that point, we realized, okay, you know, we got to step the game up because obviously some people are interested in this. And, you know, we put them in there and they sold out. So it was like, okay, you know. And so it created this whole domino effect where it was like, okay, man, we need some writers. We need some, you know, photographers, we need this, we need that. And we started going around to different colleges and high schools to recruit people to help us because, again, it was a volunteer basis. But it definitely, you know, we were trying to pattern ourselves after the source, but on a Chicago level.
Yeah, man. So you began kind of documenting, reporting about what was happening in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
This is around what year?
We launched the magazine in 93. It was supposed to come out in August of 93, but we were a month behind, so it didn't really come out until September of 93.
And how long did you guys put out zines?
From 93 up until 98.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many issues do you know?
I think it was 22.
Amazing, okay. And that was a good moment because I remember there were other publications as well.
Oh, yeah.
Flypaper,
yes.
A few others that I remember in that
era. We had
era.
Another one called Caught in the Middle. That was a magazine, but they only published two issues, but it was still relatively, you know, a local underground magazine.
Yeah. And then Chicago Rocks became an event as well?
Yes.
At the Moleman.
The Moleman started doing production events, you know, concerts and stuff like that, and they just named it Chicago Rocks.
Okay. In honor of...
Yeah, right.
Okay. And those were very dope events. Those, and they seemed to me to carry out a similar mission to Chi Rock Nation in terms of uniting a Chicago hip-hop community. One of the only nights in the year where you would see kind of everyone out.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember those nights very fondly at the Metro and other places, you know, at the Metro primarily, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us had it on our minds and hearts that we got to create our own industry, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because we didn't really have it. New York had a lot of the record labels, so did California, but then California also had a lot of the movie companies. Well, we didn't really have neither one of those things here to that extent for us. And so during the time when we were doing it, so, I mean, you know, because even years prior to that, I mean, we did have record pools and, I mean, you know, we had Chess Records here, but that stuff was long gone. I mean, the original Regal on 47th Street was long gone. So all the great performers had kind of came and passed through here. So now it was a new time in the era, and it was difficult because we were, some of us wanted to become rappers and get, you know, signed to a label, but we were trying to go to New York, and New York just wasn't trying to, they weren't trying to have us.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So during the 90s, so you're documenting what's happening. When do you get the idea to turn all of what you've lived through, created, into a larger documentary book project?
So the book came before the magazine, the concept.
Wow, okay.
So, you know,
so you've been sitting on this.
Yeah, yeah. So in 92, we actually came up with the idea to write the book first. But we was like, this is, what we did was we were just like, you know, we had been going to parties, me and my partner Fear, and meetings and all of that. And we were just like, man, that'd be cool if we put together a book. You know, and then we just immediately just started taking paper and making lists of people's names that we think they should be in the book. Mm. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And we was like, man, this would be a dope book, you know. And that's when we start interviewing people, you know what I'm saying? We had a little tape recorder, you know, and this is back when we was using all analog stuff. So
amazing.
We put the cassette in there and we just go to an event and push record and let them just tell us, you know, answer our questions. And then we like, okay, we got that. We got one interview, you know. And, you know, and then we started trying to, you know, encapsulate and compile a lot of this stuff. And when we started looking at it, we was like, wow, this is Chicago hip hop. And but then we realized, wow, this is going to cost. How are we going to do this? You know, I called a couple of publishing companies that I mentioned to you before. And they were like, you know, we're not interested in publishing anything on hip hop. You know, it was kind of foreign at the time and people just was afraid of it, I think. And so I was like, wow, how are we going to publish a book if we can't even find a publisher? You know, and so it was just like, OK. And then we knew we were going to need money. So then that's when the concept came up. Well, how about we do a magazine as a little stepping stone to work our way up? And at the time, we was generating a little money off of that. And at the same time, we were still doing interviews and kind of still documenting, but it was just on a smaller scale. And we were able to put that out every month or every 2 months.
Oh, that's amazing. So this has become your life's work, really.
Yes.
Right. Is there a date? Yeah, because we were talking beforehand. You were talking about self-publishing. Is there? Mm-hmm. Do you have a date in mind when the book comes out, or is it you're just working?
Well, so I was trying to, because the book is actually 400 pages.
Right.
So it's more of a historical reference book.
Yes.
So and it covers all the elements, all Chicago, you know, and so from going all the way back to the 70s when I could say when we had Soul Train. So I, and again, my partner Fear, he moved, so he no longer lives in Chicago. So I began to pick this project back up. I had put it down. I picked it back up in 2016, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna just try to do this thing by myself, you know, trying to still pick up and do stories and, you know, interviews and edit all of this stuff. And now I have a computer, so a lot easier. But I was like, this is just too big to put out right now as one. So it'll give me more time if I break it into sections, you know, compartments of elements. So that's what I did. And now, as I'm still working, and then it's hard to try to catch up with people to get the interviews and all of that. So, you know, it's just giving me a little bit more time. So the first volume, which is the DJ volume, is going to come out this month. So I'm actually coming. I'm doing the final editing right now so that I can submit my my manuscript files to the company that I'm going to use to actually have it done.
Dope. And what is the title of the project and what's the title of that volume?
It's called The Real Deal on the History of Chicago Hip Hop, and it's volume one.
Dope. Yo, man, it is it's just a pleasure to talk with you. And, you know, we have years and years to catch up on.
Yes.
Where if you can give out the socials one more time, where can people stay in tune with all of what you're doing?
OK, so I'm on Facebook under Daryl M. Roberts Artistic, Chi-Rock Nation as well on Facebook, on Instagram, Chi-Rock Nation. Actually, and I think I'm messed up when I mentioned it earlier, but on my personal Instagram page, it's actually Citra Photos. So Citra is my company because I do graphic designs, and that's actually artistic spelled backwards.
Ah, okay. Awesome. Well, Daryl, thank you so much, man, for being in the Corner Store, and I'm so excited to build with you and to talk with you, and very, very excited that your work will be in the world soon and we can read it, and I'm excited to do so. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Shout out our super producer, DJ Cashera. Big up boss man, Todd Manley. Thank you to our official Corner Store photog, Mercedes Zapata. Salutes to the Snack Door, Max. Also, please, y'all, follow our Instagram. It's corner_pod on IG, on Twitter. Tell us who you want to see in the Corner Store. And also, please consider dropping a couple of dollars into our Patreon account. It's patreon.com/cornerstore_pod.
The Corner Store is brought to you by Stolen Spirits.